Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much power does the pharmaceutical industry have in shaping the modern practice of medicine, and is that good for us as patients? American consumers now spend close to 20% of the nation's gross domestic product on healthcare, and a significant portion of that money pays for prescription drugs. But as my guest today will explain, U.S. life expectancy is actually falling behind that of other industrialized countries, and the huge numbers of people taking medications are also at risk for adverse drug reactions, which can be fatal. So how did we get the system we have today? Dr. David Healy is professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University and former secretary of the British Association for Psychopharmacology. He writes about all of this in his new book, Pharmageddon. David, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's good to be here.
So healthcare is nearly 20% of U.S. GDP, and drugs account for 20% of that cost. What sort of influence do drug producers then have on how doctors practice medicine?
I think they've got a huge influence. And the influence goes way beyond just how doctors use pills. The influence really extends to how healthcare is run these days. And in great part, the influence is exercised through what's called evidence-based medicine. Evidence-based medicine was the kind of arrangement that we've put in place dating back 50 years or more, when in our effort to ensure that the pills we took worked well and were reasonably safe, we began to do things like controlled trials. What we asked of the pharmaceutical companies was, before they bring a drug to the market, that they run controlled trials of their drug to show that the drug works. The trouble is, industry have begun to do more and more of the trials that are done. Very few of the trials that are done on any of the pills that people use these days have been done by people other than the company that brings the pill on the market. And increasingly, when the results of these trials don't suit the company involved, they fail to publish the trial, or, worse again, in the case of quite a few of the trials that are published, they've almost all been ghost written. And in a pretty large proportion of these trials, the ghostwriters have been able to change what's a negative result for the drug in question into a roaringly positive result. You have the FDA looking at the study and saying this is a negative study of the drug, but when people read the article that comes out of it, written by medical ghostwriters, what they find is maybe an article that appears in the New England Journal of Medicine, or one of the leading journals in the field, with an authorship line that looks like some of the really biggest names in the field. And this article says that the drug works well and it's extremely safe, which means that doctors like me think, well, you know, it should be a good thing to use and it's going to be helpful to the people that I'm seeing. Problem is, not just that the results are false, but increasingly the industry makes its money out of pills that treat lifestyle ailments as opposed to the kind of things that we need to have treated. We're handing over huge amounts of money based on trials like this for drugs that are more likely to injure us early or put us in bed and keep us off work, as opposed to pills that make sure that we don't die and get us out of our bed and back to work. If industry were producing drugs that really made us healthier, it would be worthwhile to hand over a very large amount of money, because these would be pills that would help us compete with the Chinese or the Europeans or whoever. But the problem is, we're handing over huge amounts of money for treatments that all too often keep us off work as opposed to return us to work.
What you're describing with falsified results from clinical trials, it sounds like out-and-out fraud, David. How is this possible with the oversight in this country of an agency like the FDA?
Well, what you have is FDA look at the trials that are done on a pill, but they don't get to see all of the trials that have been done. This became clear, for instance, a few years ago, about 8 years ago now, when there was concerns about the antidepressant group of drugs making children become suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
It became clear then, while FDA has seen a large proportion of the trials that have been done, they haven't seen them all. Now, what FDA have been doing up till then, and still do now, is they say that they have the opportunity to see all of, or well, to see most of the trials that have been done, but they haven't felt that it's their brief to let doctors like me, for instance, know that, well, actually, while I can see the published literature and I can see that 10 trials have been done, that in fact there have been 20 trials done and there are 10 trials that remain unpublished.
Mm.
Now, to overcome this, one of the things that happened when the fuss came out about antidepressants making children become suicidal was that New York State sued GlaxoSmithKline for fraud. They had an article, which was on Paxil, which claimed that the drug worked well and was extremely safe to give to children who were depressed. New York State had evidence that, in actual fact, the raw data pointed to just the opposite conclusion. So they sued the company for the point that you've made, which was this was fraud. As a result, the company said that, well, we will post the details of all of the trials that we do on the company on the company website. And this has led to a movement now where we know much more generally about all the trials that are being done. What we still don't have is we don't have access to the data from those trials.
So talk about this. I mean, it certainly makes sense that physicians would want to look critically even at studies published in really distinguished medical journals. You describe something like a sort of Stockholm syndrome by which physicians who certainly mean to care well for their patients end up really identifying with the drug companies that are using the doctors to sell these drugs.
Yes, there's a twofold thing. One is what happens to both you and me when we go to the doctor and we're put on a pill. Just like the original Stockholm syndrome, where this happened when people were held captive in a bank over in Sweden, and when they were able to get out after they've been held there for about 4 to possibly 5 days, the media found, to their surprise, that people who had been held there captive and with a threat to their very life came out saying nice things about the people who had been holding them hostage.
Mm.
In just the same way, when we're ill, there's a threat to our life. We're isolated by the illness we have, and increasingly we train doctors to be very nice to us, to have good communication skills, but we don't train them to realize that when they ask us are things going okay on the treatment that they've put us on, that we'll often say fine because we want to keep we're keen to keep the people holding us hostage happy. Mm. We feel that they're the way out for us. So often behind the fine is actually the fact that we're not doing all that well on the pill, and the doctor's not trained to pick this up. The other aspect to it, though, is the same way that we're vulnerable when the drugs that we need are available on prescription only, so doctors are very, very vulnerable vis-a-vis the pharmaceutical companies. They realize that if they begin to kick up a fuss about some problem that the pill causes, that the company is quite capable of isolating them, that they'll be able to create the kind of situation where the doctor whose brief it really is to raise concerns about the risks of new pills, they'll be able to make that doctor feel isolated from their peers. They'll be able to create a world where that doctor, he or she, will feel that they're not going to be able to make the kind of progress with their career that they would have actually possibly expected to be able to make. And of course, people don't talk up about the risks of drugs because the pharmaceutical company people who come to most doctors are extremely nice and they're trained to be awfully kind. They're the people that know what your husband's date of birth is or your wife's date of birth is, when their birthday is, and what your kids' names are and things like this. They're trained to be your friend. Hmm. So this makes it harder and harder for doctors also to speak up about the risks of pills.
So what happens when a series of patients eventually report to a physician that they are having a certain reaction or a certain set of side effects on a medication? What obligations does the physician have to report those, and what gets done with that information?
Well, the reason these drugs are available on prescription only is that doctors were thought to be the kinds of people who were skeptical about new drugs, and that when things went wrong, they would report the problems. These days, the estimates are that doctors really only report between 1% to 5% of the serious problems that pills cause. Hmm. They don't report the more trivial problems. They don't report that the pills may have interfered with your ability to make love, for instance. They don't report simple problems like dizziness. This pill might just cause you to be dizzy every 2 or 3 days. You might have a brief spell for 10 to 15 seconds of being dizzy. And that sounds, I'm sure, to most people tuned into the program as being a reasonably trivial thing. But people who had just this kind of problem on one of the heart drugs recently found that if this happened out of the blue every 2 or 3 days when they were driving their car, they crashed the car. Hmm. And this is the kind of thing that can lead you to lose your license and lose your job, for instance. So there can be a huge impact on the person's life. Doctors don't report this kind of information at all. So when they do report, worse again, FDA and most people tend these days to regard reports like this as just anecdotal, that they don't count compared to the controlled trials that have been done on the pill. And if the controlled trial, for instance, hasn't shown that the problem's happening frequently, then the fact that I report things that may be happening to you, for instance, gets regarded by FDA as just, well, it's a thing that could have happened by chance. Hmm. So they don't take action on it. They don't take action on it in this way. If you fly a plane, the pilot on the plane who's going to get you from the West Coast to the East Coast is on board with you. So if anything goes wrong, if there's any issue about the safety of the flight, she's concerned and she will report it, and the authorities pay heed to it because she knows that if there's anything wrong with this plane, she goes down at the same time as you go down. When your doctor puts you on a pill, though, she isn't on the same flight. Hmm. You're the one that takes the flight, and you take it on your own, and if you go down, it's very unfortunate, but it could have happened by chance. This is the kind of thing that happens to people, and doctors often don't report it. And if they do report it, the authorities, like FDA, don't pay the same heed to the reports that they pay to the reports from that the aviation board pay to reports like this. So it's a curiously different world we have.
My guest is Dr. David Healy. He's professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University and author of the new book, Pharmageddon. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can get to us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. We do have lines open now. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. David Healy. He's professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University and former secretary of the British Association for Psychopharmacology. His newest book is called Pharmageddon. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, David, let's talk a bit about how we arrived at this state of affairs. In the early 1960s in the United States, we had the disastrous effects of babies born to mothers who had been prescribed this anti-nausea drug called thalidomide during pregnancy.
That's correct. And in order to try and make sure that that didn't happen again, the birth defects that it caused, we did a few things. One was we felt we have to reward the pharmaceutical companies to if they bring new and useful drugs onto the market for us. And to do this, we fixed up that they could take out what were called product patents on drugs. There's a few different ways we could have given companies a return on the kind of investment that they have to put in to bring new drugs to the market. We can give them what's called a process patent on a drug also. And this means that, for instance, they get a reward if they bring a drug onto the market, but they can only hold the patent on the way they've made the drug as opposed to on the drug itself.
The formulation of the drug. Mm-hmm.
Yes. What this means is that if a different company can find a different way to bring the same drug on the market, they're also able to do so. Now, it turns out retrospectively that giving companies process patents on drugs was a much better way to get them to produce a wider range of drugs and to produce them more cheaply. Product patents, on the other hand, create the kind of situation where companies are inclined to put all of their eggs in one basket. If they're the only company that can make Prozac and hold the patent on it for 10 to 15 years, they realize that if they market this well, they can make a vast amount of money out of it. And as opposed to in say the 1960s, where a company that held the patent on a drug here in the United States really only marketed here in the States. These days, if you hold the patent on a drug, you hold it worldwide. Mm. So the fortunes that can be made from drugs like this are extraordinary. And as of the 1980s, this created the kind of situation where companies began to make what were called blockbuster drugs. These were often drugs that didn't particularly treat the illnesses that we need to have treated. They were drugs that companies knew there was a large market for. Drugs like Prozac, for instance, which weren't particularly good antidepressants, but that the companies knew that with good marketing, they could persuade a lot of people to have this drug, and that they could make more than $1 billion per year out of this drug. Hmm. Blockbusters came on stream during the 1980s, and by the year 2000, roughly 50% of the profits that the industry makes were from this group of drugs. Now, the problem with blockbusters for all of us is this. If a company can make a vast amount of money out of a key drug, they've got huge incentives to overhype this drug, to be able to tell you and me that this drug works for everything pretty well, and more importantly, again, to hide the problems. If there's a risk to the drug that the company knows about, and if they feel that if they let the world know about this risk, that the sales of the drug will fall, and if the sales of the drug fall, the company might fall also, you create the kind of situation where companies are not going to be transparent about the risks of their pills. So this is one of the things we put in place. It isn't the case that we need to get rid of, or that we should be saying that companies shouldn't be rewarded for the drugs that they make, but it probably is the case that we can tweak the system to make it work slightly better so that companies are rewarded still but don't have quite the incentives to hide crucial safety data from all of us the way they have been doing. The next thing we put in place prescription only a we made new drugs available on prescription only.
Now, a lot of people hear that, David, and they think, well, that makes perfect sense. You want an expert prescribing these drugs that could be used incorrectly. So what's the problem there?
The problem there is twofold, and it's a tricky one for me because I make my living out of the fact that these drugs are available on prescription only.
Mm-hmm.
The problem here is this. When drugs are available on prescription only, what most people miss is that the person who consumes the pill is me, our other doctors. We consume it by putting it into your mouth.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, what it also means then is that we're faced with a group of companies who spend more marketing drugs than any other company spends, more than Reebok, Nike, Lexus, General Motors, Apple, Microsoft, any of these companies. I mean, they all spend a huge amount trying to market the product, and they spend this money trying to market the product to all of us. The pharmaceutical companies spend more money than each of these companies, but they don't market to all of us. They just market principally to doctors who are the true consumers of the pills, and they understand doctors better than doctors understand themselves.
Hmm.
Now, there's no medical course on earth that I'm aware of which trains doctors to understand how companies market to them. And this is a key thing. I mean, if we're going to keep drugs available on prescription only, it's a thing that we need to look at. Let me just bring in this point out sort of in this way to you. The antihistamine group of drugs are a group of drugs that most people listening to the program will have had.
Mm-hmm.
Most antihistamines are drugs that inhibit serotonin reuptake also. They could act in just the same way like drugs like Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft. The SSRIs are also a group of drugs that are antihistamines. Almost all of the SSRIs we have come from an antihistamine. So there's not much difference between the antihistamines, or between quite a few of the antihistamines and the SSRIs. Antihistamines can make people who have them a lot more anxious and nervous, just like the SSRIs can. But very few people taking an antihistamine go on to commit suicide or go on to an act of violence. Lots of people taking an SSRI go on to acts of suicide and acts of violence. And the difference here partly is if you take an antihistamine over the counter and it's not suiting you, you don't keep taking it. If you take an antihistamine SSRI from your doctor and it's not suiting you, you'll often be told, because of the marketing to him, he'll have told you, well, you need to keep on having this for 2 or 3 weeks. The drugs don't work for a period of time. And if it's not suiting you, and he says that you need to keep on having it, or even asks you to put up the dose of the pill, this is precisely the wrong thing to be doing. So doctors, I mean, I think we didn't fully understand what we were doing when we made all of these drugs available on prescription only. If we're going to keep this going, doctors, I think, need to realize much more that it's in their interest to recognize how companies market to them and how the problems that a person may be having on the pills can be concealed, how their willingness to please the doctor means that they often don't voice what's truly happening to them on the pill. One of the ways I tried to bring this out to people is this. When the fuss blew up about antidepressants making people become suicidal, making children in particular become suicidal, the American Psychiatric Association issued a statement. When FDA put a black box warnings on the pills, the APA came out and said, we believe that antidepressants save lives. Now, this, in my opinion, was a professional suicide note.
Hmm.
What the APA should have said was that we believe that psychiatrists can save lives by recognizing that these pills can be awfully useful, but that they're also risky and that it takes an expert to handle these pills. The trouble is, if the pills work well and are free of risks, there are a lot less expensive people who can prescribe pills these days than doctors. There are nurses who, from the point of view of the people who run healthcare these days, if they've got a group of nurses who can prescribe the pills, they'll feel that the nurses are much more inclined, they aren't just going to be cheaper, but they're much more inclined to keep to the guidelines and protocols than people like doctors do. So it's in the interests of doctors, I think, at this point, to recognize much more that the pills have been overhyped and they come with risks, and we need experts, that is, people who can recognize the hype and recognize the risks if these pills are going to be used in a way that's going to be reasonably safe.
So let's talk about this, David. We hear, it seems, weekly about new drugs in development that will fix whatever ails us. It turns out, if you look at this really carefully, that only about 1 in 7 newly introduced drugs is demonstrably better than older drugs that treat the same condition.
That's absolutely the case, yes. But again, the companies, and what I see again and again is companies bringing new drugs onto the market, which are not just not better than the older drug on the market, but often clearly, demonstrably less effective and coming with more in the line of problems than the older drug had. And again, a further point is often with these older drugs, which come in cheaper, we know what the risk to these older drugs are. When we've got a new drug that comes on at the market, we don't know what the risks are. And one of the oddities we've got at the moment as well, which comes back to these drugs being available on prescription only, is most people seem to think prescription-only drugs have to be safer than alcohol and nicotine and cocaine and benzodiazepines and drugs like this. But in fact, new drugs are on prescription only precisely because we don't know what the risks of these new drugs are, and there's every chance that the risks are going to turn out to be greater than the risks from things like alcohol and nicotine and cocaine and benzodiazepines and drugs like this. But that's not the way either doctors or patients treat them. They treat them as the latest wonder drug, even though, as you indicated at the start of the question, they may not be actually more effective than older drugs we have, and there's every reason to think that they aren't going to be any safer and may well be a lot less safe.
What about patient compliance, David? Because there is concern among some physicians that when particular drugs that used to be available by prescription only are then moved, like some of the antihistamines that you were discussing, then they are moved to be over-the-counter, that consumers assume that they can sort of take these without paying much attention to the directions, and in fact those drugs can still be harmful without a doctor to guide the way that they're administered.
Absolutely. They can be risky. The moving drugs to an over-the-counter status isn't a way to solve all problems. But what you'd get from more drugs being available over the counter is a group of experts who are skeptical about these over-the-counter drugs. These are doctors. Doctors would be extremely skeptical about the claims you made for over-the-counter drugs compared with the drugs that are available on prescription only. So what we've got at the moment is a tricky world where it may well be that, and there are moves to get a few of the lipid, drugs like the cholesterol-lowering group of drugs made available over-the-counter. These drugs do come with a wide range of problems linked to them. There is every reason to think that the companies, when they market these drugs over the counter are going to overhype them and try to get people to have more and more of them. But there's two things that come into play here. One is that if it's over the counter and you begin to take the drug and it's not suiting you, you're less likely to keep on having it. And the other thing is that if you're having a problem from an over-the-counter drug and you go to ask your doctor, could this drug that I'm having over-the-counter be causing this particular problem, there's every chance your doctor's going to say to you, yes, it could, and you shouldn't be having it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Eric in Dallas. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I just had a comment, and then I'll take the response off the air. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, and I just wanted to kind of comment on what your guest mentioned a minute ago.
Okay.
I'm not an apologist for the pharmaceutical companies by any means. But in terms of giving antidepressants the necessary trial of, you know, 3-4 weeks, I mean, it varies, but if a person doesn't have a response to an antidepressant medication after a day or two, that's not really an indication that it shouldn't be continued. I mean, just as far as how the drug works. So I just wanted to make that comment. Appreciate your show.
Thanks so much for your call. Did you want to respond to that, David?
Not as such, but I can add to it. Maybe I think that will be a little bit helpful for both maybe Eric and anyone else who's listening to this. One of the thing about the trials that's done with, say, groups of drugs like the antidepressants is they're put in trials that only last for 6 to 8 weeks. And we're often then put on these drugs afterwards for months or years. And no one really knows what the risks of that could be.
Let me jump in there. We need to take a quick break, and I will give you a chance to finish that thought. My guest is Dr. David Healy. He's professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University and author of the new book, Pharmageddon. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Back in.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. David Healy, former secretary of the British Association for Psychopharmacology and currently professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University. His new book is called Pharmageddon. And before the break, David, you were explaining to us that a lot of drugs that we might be prescribed have followed patients in clinical trials for 6 to 8 weeks. And then in practice, we as patients are prescribed the use of these drugs for months or even years on end.
That's correct, Chris. There's two points that I'm keen to make here. One is just this, which is, given the way we bring the antidepressants on the market, the kind of trials we do, I'm sure that I could put alcohol into the same kind of trials and will come out of it with a result that looks very like the SSRIs, that you could show that it was antidepressant. Most people, however, would know that while, you know, having sort of a good quality red wine, maybe 1 to 2 glasses per day for a 6 to 8 week period while they were nervous or depressed, might be a helpful thing to do. They know that it isn't a good thing to be doing over the course of months or years, that things could go wrong. And that's the problem. That's part of the problem we face with the antidepressants and a range of other drugs that we're on, which is the trials that bring them on the market are just designed to get the company over a hurdle which gets the drug onto the market. They aren't really designed to show whether it's a safe thing for us to be on these drugs in the long term. Now, there's a further group of trials that nobody really listening to this program or anywhere else much hears about or talks about, which are trials that the companies do which much more clearly bring out the risks linked to the drugs. And these are trials that are, these are the very first trials that get done on the pills called healthy volunteer trials. It involves a group of students often, or a range of other people who have no illness being put on these drugs long before they get given to people who are depressed or have got asthma or gut problems or whatever. And the interesting thing about these trials is they don't get registered at all, and the data from the trials is not made available at all, even though there are no issues of patient confidentiality involved. But let me give you a great example of what trials like this can show and where we need to be asking for them to be made public, publicly available. And it's this. In 1983, 9 years before they launched Zoloft on the market here, and 21 years before we got any kind of warnings that these drugs could make people become suicidal, Pfizer did a trial of Zoloft in a group of healthy volunteers in the UK. They gave six of the women involved Zoloft and six women a placebo. All of the women who had been taking Zoloft by the end of the first week, even before the end of the first week, had dropped out of the trial because they'd become anxious and apprehensive, and they'd begun to think strange thoughts about being aggressive or doing unusual things. All of the things that 21 years later the company conceded the drug could do. But 21 years before that, when this trial was done in 1983, the company had written that we believe that our drug has caused these reactions in this group of healthy volunteers. And the reason trials like that are so powerful is when you take the illness component out of the picture, when you're depressed, for instance, we become anxious, so we may become suicidal. If the drug makes us anxious, or the drug also makes us become possibly suicidal, the illness masks it. And this masking doesn't happen in healthy volunteer trials. So these are key, well, these are proper drug trials, as it were. The kinds of things we usually think of as being drug trials aren't actually true drug trials. They're not trials of the drug. They're trials of treating a particular condition. And that's a crucial difference. Trials, when you're giving the drug to people who are ill, tend to mask the problems that the drug causes. And if I'm going to give the drug to you safely, a key thing for me is to know what the illness can cause, but also to know quite distinctly what the problems are that the pill can cause. This is an area that I feel extremely strongly about, and that we should really be asking companies and FDA to make data from trials like this publicly available, because I think it would make the practice of medicine a great deal safer.
Well, certainly, David, to the extent that you've been describing what sounds like corruption from pharmaceutical companies looking to hide negative responses to drugs, I can understand that there's a financial motivation to creating a blockbuster that many people need or feel they need and are prescribed and are using. However, when there are really serious adverse reactions with a drug like, say, Vioxx, we'll move away from antidepressants for now, eventually, when you have hundreds of thousands of people taking these medications, the truth will out, and it would seem that the costs of fighting lawsuits and making recompense to people who've been damaged outweigh the benefits of having lied in the first place.
I think what the companies do is they... they're able actually to factor this into the cost of doing business.
Wow.
That while they may pay a large amount of money for actually compensating people for injuries that have been caused by sort of the big name drugs that we've been hearing about in recent years, that's only here in the States. Elsewhere in Europe, for instance, there really hasn't ever been any actions against the pharmaceutical industry that have actually succeeded. There have been no payments for injuries caused at all. So while you're hearing about the big cases here that industry may have lost, it's a comparatively small amount of money compared with the amount of money that they make here in the States. But even smaller amount of money compared with the amount of money that they make worldwide. So I think things like this have been factored into account.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Elizabeth in Fort Worth who writes, one of my concerns about modern pharmaceuticals is how little time doctors are allowed to manage them, particularly in the case of psychiatric medicines. My son takes several psychiatric drugs to deal with anxiety, attention, and other issues stemming from autism. The standard psychiatric appointment that insurance will cover is 7 minutes long. We eventually moved to a different psychiatrist who does not take insurance but has appointments that are 45 minutes long. He says he cannot work in a way that insurance will cover, and I'm happy to pay him out of pocket for a more thorough approach. Any comment there?
Yes. I think this is a very real concern. And one of the things that I've been keen to do with colleagues is to create a website where people can go and register the side effects that they're having on a pill and get an expert report from us as to the likelihood that there is a linkage between the pill and the problem that they're actually having, to be able to bring back to the doctor who's put them on the pill. I think one of the issues why the consultations with doctors are so short is often because the doctor will ask, are you having a problem? And even the bravest of us, when we go in the door, we shrink from being possibly 6 foot tall to being an inch tall. We have a list of things that we think we want to ask, but we end up not asking them. What we're hoping to do is to give people an expert report, which would make it easier to raise the issues with the doctor who's put them on a pill if things are going wrong. And it's the kind of thing, if you have an expert report like this, it's not going to be possible for a doctor to terminate the consultation quite as quickly. They really will have to take it into account. So, but I think you're right. I mean, I think the caller into the program really has a key point, which is that doctors often these days are treating numbers rather than people. They may have screened us for our lipid levels, our bone densities, our breathing rates, or the scores that we have when we filled up some behavioral checklist. And they're treating numbers like that as opposed to looking at us closely and recognizing differences between how we look now and how we looked when we were in last. And all too often, because of this, and this is a point that I made early on, people who run healthcare these days tend to think of it as being evidence-based. The trials have shown what can be done, what ought to be done, and it doesn't really actually matter which doctor you see. You know, the idea that you see the same doctor from week to week isn't a thing that plays big in the way we run healthcare these days. I think we need to recognize that it's actually a key thing, that it's awfully important that the doctor you have is the one that you see routinely, and that he or she gets to spend much more time with you and gets to look at you and treat you, as opposed to treating the numbers that may show up on the computer screen that they're all too often also looking at us at when they're supposed to be looking at us.
So, as you well know, overhauling the way we do healthcare in this country is not something that happens easily or quickly. Assuming that the way drugs are developed and tested and prescribed is not going to change anytime soon, what do you recommend to patients besides perhaps going online, looking up symptoms and side effects of drugs that they have been prescribed? What do they say to their doctors when they walk in? What do we say to be sure that we are effectively communicating things that the doctor needs to know in order to make good decisions?
I think a key thing we have to do is not just get people to go online and check what the problems are that their pill may be causing, we've got to be able to link people up so that if you're having a particular problem on a pill, you don't think you're the only one that's having it.
Hmm.
You get to know that there's a bunch of other people that have had this problem also, and ideally get to know that there's a lot of other doctors who think that there can be a linkage between the pill that you're having and the problem that you're now also having. I think one of the things that the internet gives us the opportunity to do is to empower people, to mobilize them, to recognize that they aren't as isolated as they were, and that there is a chance, if their hunch is that something strange and new that's happening on this pill that they're on now that wasn't there before is quite likely to be linked to the pill, even if the evidence base that doctors operate from says that there is no linkage. And I think this is probably the key thing to helping rein in healthcare costs, because at least the fourth leading cause of death these days is treatment-induced death. One of the greatest sources of disability is treatment-induced disability. And we're paying not just for the pills that we take, but we're also paying for the treatment costs of trying to treat the injuries that the pills have caused to us. And it's this that's leading. This is one of the greatest factors in the escalation of healthcare costs that we have now. What we need to do is to try and turn this round. And this is the point at which the interests of doctors and the interests of patients and the interests of insurance companies coincide. Everybody has an interest, if they think about it, in trying to detect adverse events early and make sure that we intervene and make sure that the problem doesn't escalate. So that's the key thing that I think we need to work on. And if we do that, I think we can, between us, do a great deal to rein in the escalation of healthcare costs that we have at the moment and make clinical practice better and safer.
Dr. David Healy is professor of psychiatry at Cardiff University and former secretary of the British Association for Psychopharmacology. His new book is called Pharmageddon. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much, Chris, for having me. It's been great fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions you may have to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.